Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. It is Friday, September 11th, 2020. Every week, we check in with Publishers Weekly for the latest news and analysis on books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, joins me today. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So this Friday segment on Beyond the Book has been on a three-week summer hiatus, which means there's plenty to catch up on today. Leading off is the not-so-surprising news that Frankfurt Book Fair organizers announced this week that the show will go on, but virtual only.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but I think, you know, as you say, most of the publishing world probably did expect that the Frankfurt Book Fair would be hard-pressed to pull off an in-person fair, and this week, organizers indeed announced that it has canceled the physical in-person fair that they were planning and will proceed as an entirely virtual online event. You can read all about what the fair will look like on the PW site. We've got a couple of stories up there, and I'll just mention briefly that the dates are not changing. The virtual fair will take place as scheduled from October 12th to the 18th. And exhibitors who were registered for this year's fair are going to have their registrations converted to one for the digital fair automatically. You don't need to re-sign up. And in addition, their payments, the exhibitor payments, are going to be refunded or rolled over into 2021, depending on what the company chooses. So pretty fair options there. And registrations for everyone, I should note, for this year and for all programs affiliated with the fair are going to be free through June of 2021. There's going to be some more programs throughout the early months of 2021.
So what changed for Frankfurt, Andrew? Up until this week, they had been pretty publicly bullish on having some physical component to the fair, and you two were thinking they just might pull it off.
Yeah, you know, knowing the fair and knowing the organizers as I do, I really thought that if anyone was going to pull it off, it would be Frankfurt. But alas, it turns out that nobody was going to pull it off in 2020. And as we noted on the show, whatever physical event was going to happen, Americans were not going to be there. You know, all the major houses have already backed out. We've talked about that on this show. And then, of course, there was the pesky little issue of Americans not being allowed entry into Europe. Well, in the end, it was the COVID-19 travel restrictions that led to the cancellation. In an online interview following the announcement, Frankfurt Book Fair director Jürgen Bose spoke of how new restrictions around the world, including in Europe, as cases begin to tick up again, meant that travel, you know, and not only for people, but for the freight, and you've been to many fairs, you've seen how big an operation it is. Well, you know, getting all those people and getting exhibitor stands and stock into the fair, well, it just wasn't feasible.
So what do you think cancellation for the industry's biggest trade show portends for 2021?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, and it's never too early to start thinking about that because, you know, back in March, I'm not sure everyone believed that we'd still be canceling shows and in this tough a shape in the fall, right? I mean, before you know it, we're going to be talking about the 2021 London Book Fair, the first major fair last year to fall prey to the pandemic. I mean, I think we have to be prepared to write off most of 2021, right? You know, I don't believe there's going to be a vaccine in place, despite some people believing otherwise, or that there's going to be any other miracle that is going to change the situation in terms of the pandemic. And, you know, let's not lose sight of what counts here. You know, we're approaching 200,000 deaths in the U.S. from this virus, which is just terrible. And you know, I know the industry has been pretty laser focused on safety, and I think that's to be applauded. And I think that's going to probably continue until we're absolutely sure that it's safe to continue. But I do take some comfort in, you know, Jürgen Bose's comments, because he noted that the fair has invested a few million euros into its digital platform. And Jürgen also insisted that there's going to be a physical event in Frankfurt in the future, whether that's 2021 or at a later time. The Frankfurt Book Fair is committed to sticking around. And on the upside of that, because they've invested in their digital technology and in the virtual event, the fair's reach has now been expanded through these virtual offerings. So that's a potential positive there too. And you know, last year's fair at Frankfurt, that was a great success. It was a great fair. Attendance was up, I think more than 300,000 total attendance, including the public day. So I'm just going to double down on what I've said in the past. You know, it's a great team in Frankfurt. They're bold, they're committed, and I think that they're going to find a way to come out of this stronger. I really do. But let's get this pandemic out of the way first. That's the focus right now, and rightly so.
In the last podcast before our Labor Day break, we were marveling at how well the publishing industry has weathered the pandemic. And since then, we have seen several more impressive numbers and more big titles.
Yes. So, you know, in terms of trade books, that's really been the bright spot here, as opposed to like education, which I'll get to in a moment. But, you know, we got this week's AAP StatShot numbers, and sales of adult books continue to surge. They rose a stout 21% for July over July of 2019. And kids' books increased 14.5% for the month. So, you know, trade books, despite bookstores being at reduced capacity, well, trade sales just continue to boom. It's really been remarkable. For other segments, however, not so much. As expected, given all the uncertainty with colleges and schools, the educational sector is continuing to plummet. In fact, overall, the decline in educational sales were enough to pull down overall industry sales down about 10% for the month of July. So that's with a 21% increase in trade sales. Overall sales were still down 10% for the month when you factored in education and other sectors. But for the first 7 months of 2020, it's been a remarkable start to the year. You know, sales of adult books are up almost 5%, I think 4.6% over the same period, the same 7 month period from a year ago. And sales of children's and YA titles are up 7.5%. And I'm not sure any of us would have predicted when we first started going on lockdown, given the hit that the economy has taken and is still going to be taking and the shuttered retail landscape, I'm not sure any of us would have predicted as strong a year as we've seen so far. On the other hand, we have a lot more time to read, right? We're you know, certainly there's a lot more free time for many people. And for trade books, the Trump administration continues to be a major boost for publishers. You know, we've been talking about it all summer. You know, trade sales have been juiced. They were juiced in late June by the release of John Bolton's The Room Where It Happened. And then in mid-July, we had Mary Trump's Too Much and Never Enough. Both of those became million sellers, like immediately out of the gate. And now we have Michael Cohen and Bob Woodward's new books. That's going to juice sales even further. You know, you throw in a new Stephanie Meyer book in there, and yeah, you were having a pretty good year. Digital formats are also on the rise. This is another part of the story that I think is going to be well worth exploring more deeply when we have a little perspective on it. But for July, digital downloadable audio sales were up 21% over last year. And ebook sales, which have been in decline for years, were up 20.7%. And that's a sharp increase, especially considering, you know, as I said, how poorly ebooks had really performed over the last 5 years or so. You know, through July, downloadable audio sales were up 15.4% over the first 7 months of 2019. And ebook sales for the first 7 months of the year are up over 10% from 2019 numbers. So just remarkable there too. You can read more about these numbers and others on the PW site, but like I said a few weeks ago, they continue to defy gravity. And again, just remarkable.
And some late summer developments too, Andrew, in the court cases we've been following. An important ruling came late last week in the lawsuit pitting Barnes & Noble and the former CEO against each other.
Yeah, so a major development in the battle between Barnes & Noble and their fired CEO, Demos Parneros. A federal judge in New York last week dismissed a defamation claim filed by Demos Parneros, but ruled that a trial can proceed on another claim, which was for the breach of the covenant of good faith. So a decidedly mixed decision, and it comes after Barnes & Noble last year moved for partial summary judgment on two of the three claims that were filed by Parneros after he was unexpectedly fired by the company in a bombshell lawsuit in July of 2018. I think the lawsuit was actually filed in August. He was fired in July of 2018. You know, in knocking out that defamation claim, it's a potentially big deal. It's a potentially substantial victory for Barnes & Noble because in previous cases, Parneros was said to be seeking approximately $70 million in damages for the defamation claim alone. At the same time, while that's kind of a big deal for Barnes & Noble, barring a settlement, this case is far from over. There's a breach of contract claim that was not addressed in any of these summary judgment motions, so that remains alive. And while the court did dismiss the defamation claim, as I mentioned, it denied Barnes & Noble's bid to knock out the former CEO's claim for the breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. So at this moment, we're still hurtling towards a trial.
And last year, when motions were filed, the judge at the time warned Barnes & Noble it was a risky move to try to knock out two of the three claims. filed by their former CEO. So tell us again, Andrew, why was it such a risky move and whether or not you think the gamble they made really paid off?
Sure. So it was a risky move because if Barnes & Noble had lost these summary judgment motions, well, that was pretty much going to be the ball game from them, right? I mean, if based on the evidence before the court decided at the summary judgment stage that there was to be a triable claim on defamation, that's a pretty strong signal as to how the trial was going to go, right? On the upside, knocking out the defamation claim limits Barnes & Noble's exposure greatly, and it gives them much more leverage for a potential settlement down the road. Now, the question, was it worth it? And I'm not so sure it was, because this is a mixed decision. The decision to knock out the defamation claim, in fact, was pretty narrow. So our listeners will recall that when Parneros was fired, Barnes & Noble issued a vaguely worded press release that announced the firing. And, you know, Parneros said that implied sexual misconduct. It kind of lumped Parneros in with the Harvey Weinsteins of the world. And in 2018, that was a very hot issue. And it kind of made the longtime executive unemployable. That's the claim for defamation in a nutshell. But that press release only said that Parneros was fired for violations of company policy. Everything else was simply implied. And in the press release, the company didn't say what the violations were. They didn't say sexual harassment. And the court held that that vague statement was essentially a true statement. Indeed, Parneros indisputably was fired for violations of company policy. However, in the court's opinion, there were some warning signs for Barnes & Noble, because the court noted that the board's decision may be unfair. The court noted that maybe Parneros didn't engage in the conduct of which he was accused, or that maybe the conduct didn't violate any company policies. And if that's the case, those claims can be addressed in the former CEO's claims for breach of contract and for the breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, the two claims that remain.
So tell us what those claims hinge on and what this all means going forward.
Yeah, so central to Parneros' case is that, in fact, he didn't break any company policies, and that the reasons for his firing, I should say, were actually just ginned up by a really angry Len Riggio, who was then the CEO of Barnes & Noble, after a deal to sell the company had collapsed. The breach of contract claim stems from the decision not to give Parneros his severance as contractually required. Because he was fired for cause, in theory, the company decided to withhold his severance. And the covenant of good faith claim, well, that stems from the decision to rush through the firing of the CEO just days before he had an equity award that was set to vest. The covenant of good faith essentially says that one party in a contract can't undermine the contract by acting in bad faith. An example of bad faith would be making up a false harassment claim to justify a firing. And though the court held that there was, in fact, a triable question here as to whether rushing to fire Demos Parneros just days before his equity award was set to vest, whether that was done deliberately and maliciously. So what happens now? How do you not settle, right? This has been going on for over 2 years. And it's worth pointing out, too, that Barnes & Noble, while they deny Parneros' claims and the company is countersuing, they're actually thinking of clawing back some of the CEO's compensation. But there's some pretty big meatballs out there, right? There's some pretty big potential claims. And, you know, our listeners may not recall, but the bombshell suit that Parneros filed was pretty ugly. So there's a potentially very ugly trial still on the line here. All of this could have been avoided, of course, just by paying the man his severance and the bonus he'd earned, I'd point out.
And finally, we have a schedule in the copyright case filed by four publishers against the Internet Archive over its unusual book scanning operation.
Yeah, so I guess this one will be on the back burner for a while, but the parties have laid out a discovery plan that will take a year till at least, I think they're not scheduled to finish up until September 20th of 2021. And that's the best case scenario. And under the best case scenario, the court set a potential schedule that would have the case ready for trial by mid-November of 2021. Again, I think that schedule is highly unlikely to hold, I'd argue, given the potential complexity of the case and how thorny the discovery could be. But it's a pretty long window. And I would say that this window also opens another window for a potential settlement. So we don't know if talks are going to be underway. The parties have until December 20th to tell the court whether they'd like to take advantage of a magistrate judge for settlement talks. But anyway, we have a schedule, so stay tuned.
Well, whatever those litigants do settle for, we won't settle for anything less than Andrew Albanese every Friday on Beyond the Book. Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on Beyond the Book, over the past two decades, the Research for Life Initiative has sought to close the world's knowledge gap. A global coalition of UN entities, NGOs, publishers, and universities, Research for Life now provides free or very low-cost access to thousands of research publications, books, and online resources in lower and middle-income countries. A new white paper assesses the current level of uptake on open access publishing models in those countries and examines barriers to adoption of OA. Andrea Powell is a co-author.
So open access does create a whole new set of challenges. On the one hand, it makes a large amount of content much more readily accessible because there are no subscription barriers. And in fact, we include about 14,000 open access journals in the Research for Life collection. So, you know, we ensure that access to that content is easy for our registered users. But on the other hand, open access as a publishing business model creates a different kind of obstacle because it prevents researchers with limited access to funds from publishing in those outlets. So while the open access model has created, in many ways, a more level playing field for access to knowledge, when it comes to being part of the research process and making one's own research available for those researchers who are striving to become part of the international research community, it simply moves the barrier to a different place.
Achieving an equitable transition to open access. Next on Beyond the Book. Our program is produced by Copyright Clearance Center. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Briskey of Burrist Marketing. You can subscribe to Beyond the Book wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. The complete Beyond the Book podcast archive is available at beyondthebook.com. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening and join us again soon on CCC's Beyond the Book.